Hello and welcome to the Non-Breaking Space Show. Our guest for this episode is Jeremy Kieft, maker of websites and writer of books about the web. You can find Jeremy on the web over at adactio.com and on Twitter at adactio. Your hosts are Christopher Schmidt and Sam Kapp, and during their chat with Jeremy, they run the gamut of the web. Progressive enhancement, depending on a database, sirens, the death of the web services, the telegraph, transcriptions, CERN, and preparing for a great talk. Now, during the recording of our conversation with Jeremy, there's some random tapping that got picked up by the mic. If you think you can identify what is making that sound, tweet us at NBSPTV with your guess, and we'll give some sort of digital prize to the person who can figure it out. So never mind the tapping, enjoy the show.
Well, thanks, Jeremy Kieft is with us. Thank you for being here.
It's a pleasure to be here.
And Sam is here, co-host.
Yes, hello.
Yes. Cool. So, you're in town for Event Park, which is why we're actually able to do this. This is our, if all the technical stuff works out, it'll be our third in-person interview on Non-Breaking Space. So usually just Skype and, and talk like that. So
this is nice, face-to-face.
Yeah.
Feels good.
And you're actually on our short list of people we really want to talk to. But I always feel like, he's over there. Or like
the time zone difference can be a pain.
Yeah. So. But so glad you're in town and able to...
It's nice, nice to be in your time zone.
Yeah. you have a great blog I want to talk about, and some things that you've come across a lot of things that web developers' desires need to know. And I mean, you wrote the HTML5 book for Bookport. Mm-hmm. So I guess my first question would be, when is an update to that going to happen?
you and Mandy both. She keeps bugging me about this. Yeah. I'm not keen on second editions or updates in general.
Yeah.
Like, I feel like books are kind of a slice of a particular time.
Yeah, history books.
Yeah, and then you know, leave them be and write a new book if you've got something to say. But Mandy was bugging me to at least update the first chapter, which is a bit about the history of the WG and the W3C, mm-hmm. because since the book was written... You know, the WG now call HTML5 just HTML, the living standard. Mm-hmm. So maybe there'll be a few words, but it wouldn't be a new book. It would just be mm-hmm. an added paragraph. Oh, also, I think later on in the semantics section, I did end up including H group, which is now gone. Mm-hmm. And I remember at the time dilly-dallying, this feels like it's not necessarily safe. Like,
oh, really?
Its existence was not guaranteed.
How do you feel about H group as an element, though?
So at the time when it was all being discussed, you know, when it was going into the mix, I was like, this seems so silly. This is not a good element, right? That the outer element, H group, would change the meaning of an inner element, like H2 or H3 or H4. There's no other situation in HTML where that happens. And also the use case just didn't seem to me to be that common.
Right.
After that, I kept coming across use cases where I was using H group. Mm-hmm. It would be exactly the kind of thing described in the spec, where it's, you know, title, mm-hmm. tagline, title, subtitle.
Yeah.
And I found myself using it, you know, quite a bit. And I realized, it does have a purpose. And right. now it's gone.
Again. Yeah.
So yeah, I had to go back and take out all my H groups.
Yeah, I like talking about it when, you know, we're all talking about the newness of HTML5 when it came out. And so, but, you know, they also, people were talking about the SEO impact of it. Of having all these multiple headings and stuff like that, but
you never do anything out of SEO interest. And then don't get me started.
Right, but then you also have the problem with, like, you have H group, but then you have people with their CMSs, and they're not in control of their CMSs. They're just in control of, like,
but in a way, it's precisely that I think made the sectioning content part of HTML so interesting. The idea that once you open a piece of sectioning content, like a section or an article, on a side or an nav, I'm not sure why those are included. It's effectively a mini document, mm-hmm. and you can start from an H1 or an H2. It doesn't matter. Start from whatever you like,
right.
but it's self-contained, and you know it'll fit into the outline of the overall document fine. Now, for CMSs, that struck me as a plus. That mm-hmm. everything could be very modular, and you didn't have to worry about, well, where is this going to fit in the overall page. That was my thinking. I haven't actually seen many CMSs take advantage of that, and generally, the whole outline algorithm thing hasn't really been. Clicking with people.
Yeah.
I haven't really grasped it. Is it interesting with H group, though? I was saying that the fact that there's an outer element that changes the meaning of the inner element. So
right.
I was chatting with Tantek, recently about HTML in general and semantics, and he was kind of half joking saying he's thinking of writing HTML to good parts. Because, and I'm like, what do you mean? It's all good. It's HTML. Yeah. HTML is great. And he's saying, no. The fact that some elements are dependent on their context is a weakness. So a paragraph is always a paragraph.
Right.
Fine, you know, an emphasis is always an emphasis, as strong as what's strong. But a list item has to be inside a UL or an OL.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a DT or DD has to be inside a
right,
DL.
Yeah.
A TR has to be inside a table. All those instances where the usage depends on its outer container complicates things, particularly, you know, for people trying to learn this from scratch.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
That's one more level. And one of the great benefits of HTML historically, I think, has been the ease of learning it.
Well, it's also been, browsers are very forgiving.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's definitely by design.
Yeah, right. I was going to say, one of the most common things that happens in my intro to HTML class is they list their list items without any OL or UL around it. The browsers are completely forgiving, and they keep asking me, why is
matter?
That? It's working fine. My bullets are there.
The only issue why that, and so on the face of it, I would say, so yeah, just don't even bother having the outer containers, right? Just use your list items.
Mm-hmm.
What the browser is actually doing is the browser is then generating an outer container, like
mm-hmm.
a UL, I think, by default. And that could come back to bite you on the ass in your CSS.
Mm-hmm.
Right, exactly.
If you have CSS, it's expecting the li to be, you know, the first child or something. And
mm-hmm.
actually, according to the DOM now, it is inside a UL, even though you didn't put any UL there.
Mm-hmm.
So that leads to pain further down the
yeah.
line. But I agree that the forgiving nature of browsers is actually definitely a feature,
mm-hmm.
not a bug.
Yeah, and that's when they bring that up. I bring the pain of the validator right next after that.
Yeah. Well, the validator. So here's the interesting with the validator is that it was always, you know, it was always intended as kind of a tool for authors, right, to like just check that you're doing the right thing and then validating as the document. But a lot of people were also using it as a lint tool.
Mm-hmm.
I think during the XHTML years.
Right.
So it's like just making sure that your coding style was good. In other words, all lowercase, you're quoting all your attributes, blah, blah, blah. And with HTML5, where it's like, yeah, you do whatever the hell you want, you know, quote, unquote, uppercase, lowercase,
mm-hmm.
yeah, it doesn't matter. A lot of people freaked out and were like, oh, but the validator will be completely useless now. It's like, well, no, the validator's still validating. It's not linting anymore.
Yeah.
What you actually wanted was a lint checker for style.
Yeah.
Two very different things. Actually, yeah, browsers, I mean, the DOM that's produced from a document with a mixture of uppercase and lowercase and quoted and unquoted attributes and missing opening tags or closing tags for things is exactly the same as a beautifully structured, you know, well-written, all lowercase, all quoted document to the browser. It's all the same.
Well, that kind of brings me up to my next point, is that you want to talk about Dan Mullen has a Twitter account and a Tumblr now, I believe it's Tumblr, called Side JavaScript. And so those are all pages that don't work or don't work well if you don't have JavaScript installed. So basically some of the examples you have are just screenshots of empty sites, you know, just blank canvas, if you will. Okay.
Yeah.
You have an empty viewport. And so what do you...
I actually had something similar in my talk at Event Apart. I had like, you know, go to squarespace.com,
mm-hmm.
switch off JavaScript. It's,
yeah.
It's nothing, it's like a little Squarespace logo, nothing else.
Yeah.
Facebook, blank page. But... you know, there was a pushback against Dan's blog. Tom Dale wrote a post arguing that progressive enhancement was dead, and I disagree with that, and we just agreed to differ. But something he did bring up, was, and I kind of have to agree with, was the tone kind of having a Tumblr blog that kind of points a finger and says, ha-ha, you're doing it wrong. Now, Dan did write a blog post to explain that's not what he's intending, you know, it's meant to be lighthearted, humorous. But I feel with something like Side JavaScript, and actually more to the point, there was a mobile WTF from Brad
mm-hmm.
Frost and Jen Simmons. It's like this kind of pointing the fingers at people doing it wrong, or you know, we believe we're doing it wrong. I'm not sure it's that productive.
Yeah,
and I know it's meant humorously, but I don't like that. And I know I catch myself doing it as well. You know, but it's like the classic thing of just people outing their thoughts on Twitter in 140 characters with a fail hashtag and like not thinking that there's, you know, human beings who made those things. But it's a funny Tumblr blog.
Well, it's also like to the point like Matt like Wilto actually is like, I would tell you about this cool website, but there's a bug in it and I don't want to tell you about it because then I'll get bug requests via Twitter.
Yeah, exactly.
So
I don't want to get... Yeah, Twitter is a customer support medium. It's not good. But the other thing with Dan's blog, is in a way it's, and I think maybe this is what Tom Dale got distracted by. In a way, it is a distraction because turning off JavaScript or having JavaScript turned off is not the issue. In fact, browsers now make it really, really hard to switch off JavaScript.
Right.
I'm not even sure if it's possible anymore in Safari. Progressive enhancement isn't about making it work when JavaScript is switched off or unavailable. I know years ago it used to be the case that it was internal networks where they would switch off JavaScript, you know, for security reasons or whatever, but those days are gone. But progressive enhancement is much more about dealing with the unexpected, right? Like someone switching off JavaScript, that's a known use case. You say, okay, we'll plan for that. And progressive enhancement is much more about all the things you can't plan for. Like the JavaScript is enabled, but let's say you're on a mobile operator's network, and they very helpfully compress and minify your JavaScript to do some. This happens, right?
Right.
They send it through their own proxy server and screw up your JavaScript, and you're like, there's nothing you can do about that, unless you're using progressive enhancement, in which case it's going to degrade down to just plain old-fashioned, you know, links and forms like that.
Right.
Or as Jake Archibald tweeted, you know, every website is a JavaScript off website before the JavaScript is finished loading, and maybe something goes wrong there on the network. The example I was using in my talk wasn't a JavaScript off situation. I think the one that really drives it home was the error handling model of JavaScript being very unlike HTML that we were just discussing. Whereas HTML is really forgiving, so is CSS, right? And this is how we can start adding new HTML tags or new CSS properties, and that's fine because a browser will see them, not understand them, ignore them.
Great.
But if you use a bit of JavaScript, a browser doesn't understand. The JavaScript part will stop, throw an error to the user. So it's a much more brittle error handling. I mean, it's a programming language. Okay? It needs to have that kind of error handling. And it's not nearly as strict as, you know, strongly typed languages. But still, just in comparison to HTML or CSS, it's definitely the strictest of the three technologies in the front-end stack. So just from an engineering perspective, it doesn't make sense to put all your requirements into that basket, right? That's the one that's the most brittle. It makes more sense to make sure your content is in the HTML. And the example I used in my talk was that the website, the download page for Google Chrome, Google site, I had a screenshot of it with a JavaScript error in the console. For about 2 hours, nobody in the world could download Google Chrome because the button on the page, it was a link, but the link said href equals JavaScript colon something, and then in the JavaScript file there was one error, something completely unrelated, you know, but just maybe a missing comma or something small like that. But it was enough that the whole JavaScript failed, and so that link didn't work because it wasn't a genuine href value, right? If you'd used progressive enhancement, you could have, you know, fallen back to just having a link that, you know, actually points to something,
right?
So it's that example of, they obviously didn't anticipate that. They didn't plan to have an error in their JavaScript for 2 hours. But progressive enhancement deals with those situations that you can't anticipate. So the switching off JavaScript thing is a bit of a red herring. Although it does make for a fun Tumblr.
Yes, it does. I would say, like, isn't that kind of like the, I guess, the moving, I guess, one of the touchstones of Bulletproof Ajax, right? The book.
Yeah. It's really interesting. So Bulletproof Ajax was basically progressive enhancement applied to Ajax because so funny, with progressive enhancement, it just keeps reoccurring as the most robust methodology, I guess, because it's not a specific technology. It's just it's an approach. It's a
way of approaching things.
Yeah. And no matter what new technologies come along, it keeps coming back as, like, actually, this seems to be, just from an engineering perspective, this seems to be the most robust way of dealing with new technology. And sure enough, when Ajax came along, I mean, I was very excited. It was great. I was talking a lot about JavaScript at the time. You know, I'd done DOM scripting, and I was speaking at a conference about JavaScript. And Ajax comes along, and everyone goes crazy, and they throw the rule books out the window. They're like, we're going to use Ajax as a requirement for everything. And if you don't have the capabilities to execute this JavaScript, you get nothing. Right? Yeah. Kind of like trying to turn the web into a plugin. Like Flash, you know, either you have the plugin installed or you don't. Either you get all the content or you get nothing. And I was mystified by this and getting kind of angry. I was like, no, just use progressive enhancement. Write a proper HTML document, use links, use forms, and you know, intercept those clicks and those submits using your JavaScript, you know, hijack it, if you will.
Yeah.
The whole hijacks thing. And come up. Hey, everyone was coining buzzwords. Right?
Ajax, I don't hijacks. Blame you. There's no shame. It's a safe zone.
I'm not proud. But it, to me, it seemed kind of obvious. And then nobody was really talking about that. Oh, great, I'm going to have to write another book now, aren't I? And I didn't want to. Like, the experience of writing a book was not pleasurable.
Yes.
But I felt like if I don't do this, nobody else is going to. I'm going to have to, right. to write about it. But essentially, you can boil down the entirety of Bulletproof Ajax into apply progressive enhancement to Ajax.
Right.
That's it.
Yeah.
That's all there was to it.
Yeah. Yeah, well, it's a good book. Okay, I enjoyed it.
Oh, thank you.
I want to transition that just a little bit in terms of talking about JavaScript, side JavaScript, and having to turn it off. A little bit about archiving and digitization. Mm-hmm. So if your site is completely JS, how, you know, is there, you know, what is the ramifications of archiving that? I mean, we have internet.org for archiving old stuff, but...
Archive.org, yeah.
Yeah, archive.org, but it's just like...
Yeah, I guess it's similar to what Google would see, mm-hmm. Although Google's bot now parses JavaScript and stuff. You know, I hadn't thought about the effects on the long-term storage, because the data is still probably stored somewhere in some file system, like JSON files maybe,
yeah.
or maybe it's in a database or something. But yeah, no, it's just a point. I tend not to get down to the level of the actual formats of the implementation, but it would seem that it's an inherently more fragile
mm-hmm.
way of delivering your content, so... The chances of it lasting into the future would be pretty slim compared to, you know, flat HTML documents. But equally so, I mean, I'm using a database for my blog, and I feel pretty uncomfortable about that.
Yeah.
Over a long enough time scale, that's a dependency I'm not really comfortable relying on. And it's funny to see people go back to flat files. Mm. There's like this kind of craze right now for CMSs where
yeah.
you just store stuff in, you know, Dropbox's Markdown, and they're just like, actually, it's pretty robust, and obviously, it's great for performance when you're just hitting the file system rather than making a database call.
Yeah.
So in general, I guess the closer you get to it literally being an HTML file
right.
sitting on the server, the better its chances. But I need to practice that myself.
Yeah.
Move away from this MySQL dependency that I've currently got.
Well, it's a good drug. I mean, it's worked for a long time.
Yeah, it has worked,
yeah.
but I feel a little nervous. You know, I make backups and all that. I got local copies, but yeah, generally, you know, you want to be pretty sure. I think an HTML file sitting on a server, no includes, no server-side programming, for the actual content stuff.
Yeah.
Obviously,
yeah.
for applications, you need,
yeah.
You know, the database and stuff.
Yeah, so there's Kirby, there's
Kirby's.
Jekyll,
yeah,
that's pretty nice. So.
Yeah, a bunch of them.
And Jekyll, if you use on GitHub, it's pretty, pretty sweet too, so you can post your pages on there, or say on that. So.
Yeah, it's so funny how we kind of keep coming back to stuff that we did back in the 90s that
yeah.
we used to think we were like, oh, this is so amateurish, you know, real sites, you know, use includes and databases
right.
and stuff, and
yeah.
it's professional. And now we're coming back to, no, you actually, performance reasons, having a flat HTML file sitting
mm-hmm.
on the server is the fastest way of getting it out there. It's like,
yeah.
everything old is new again.
Yeah.
With Kirby, I think for the blogging features, it's all just text file,
yeah,
and
yeah.
as long as you have the right fields filled out, or you don't even mention them,
yeah.
just put
Kirby.
Down.
Kirby's made by this really smart German kid, Bastian.
I
got to meet him earlier this year, and he's been blogging some great stuff. Mm-hmm. Basically, kind of related to the whole indie web movement,
mm-hmm.
which I've been getting very, very into. About owning your own data.
Well, like even Zelman was like, you know, it was Independence Day, right? The old
yeah,
day.
Way back in the day,
yeah,
yes.
So,
that's right. We used to,
yeah.
it was little like buttons we could stick in our site.
Yeah, exactly. And now
before your time, Sam.
yeah, I thought Independence Day was a movie with Bill Pullman.
It's both.
They ripped it off from Zelman.
Yeah,
it
was like,
that speech, Zelman originally gave that speech.
But, yeah, so, I just lost my train of thought there, yeah. But, yeah, so the head of South by Interactive, Sean Keefe, actually.
Mm.
He gave a keynote at DrupalCon Camp Austin. And it was so South by. It was like everything about South by that you love was like in his keynote. And
nice.
He reminded everyone that to do your own blog and to host
yeah.
your own stuff and not
mm-hmm.
put it on Facebook just because you want to own your own data, right?
And you
yeah.
and I have had this conversation
yes.
yeah.
plenty of times.
So, I mean... Okay, maybe the content will eventually disappear, but it should be your decision when it disappears and
mm-hmm.
not some third party who gets bought up by Yahoo or Google or whatever and then writes a blog post beginning, we're really excited to announce, and finishes with, thank you for joining us on our incredible journey,
right.
and you've got 2 months to get your data out, and we're shutting it all down.
Exactly. Well, like even from Instagram going to Facebook, right? That was kind of a...
It wasn't
that too much of a change, but you saw the deal with the policy issues of Facebook.
yeah, having... Well, here's the interesting thing. When you sign up for a service, it's always a very one-way conversation. Mm-hmm. They list their terms and conditions.
Yeah.
You don't get to ask. I've got some questions. What's your plan for the next 5 years? What's your plan for the next 10 years? What do you plan to do if you don't make money? What do you plan to do if you get bought out by a larger company? Do you have any guarantees in place? They don't list these by default. Mm-hmm. Like they want you to come in, and they don't say, and they don't tell you when you're signing up. By the way, make sure you make a backup of anything you add to our servers, because we're not guaranteeing anything here. And then that's why people are kind of shocked and surprised when they read the blog post saying, hey, we've been bought up by Google or Twitter or Yahoo, and you've got 2 weeks to get all your data out.
But we're really excited.
But we're really excited. I was talking about this at a talk in Germany, and I was just quoting blog post after blog post. They were literally all the same. They all began with, you know, really, there's a Tumblr blog called Our Incredible Journey.
I think it's where I found off of your tweet. Yeah.
Ourincrediblejourney.tumblr.com. Yeah. And then somebody tweeted at me that it was exactly like that scene in The Office, the original UK Office, where David Brent walks in saying he's got good news and bad news. It's like, bad news, you're all fired. But good news, I got a promotion. And somebody says, that's not good news and bad news. That's bad news and irrelevant news. And I feel that's how these blog posts are. It's like, they're really happy. They're excited. And everything's like, no, that's bad news and irrelevant news.
Right.
Yeah. But yeah, the owning your own data thing, I mean, I've said it for a long time, but it seems like more and more people are coming around to it because they're getting burned. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe, you know, it's a matter of when, not if. Like for me, I remember, you know, I used to keep my links on Delicious.
Yes.
That didn't work out too great. I moved over to Magnolia. That didn't work out too good either.
Apparently Delicious is coming back.
Yeah, whatever. I mean, it's technically it still exists, but I moved over to using my own system, and I'm not going to move back. Links are fairly easy. That's fairly straightforward. Mm-hmm. Pictures are hard. I've still got thousands on Flickr. And
there's no way to download all.
No,
them.
You can. I can download it, but that's not. It's not about downloads. It's not about having local copies. I want them on the web. I want them at URLs. Ideally, I'd like them at, you know, URLs that don't change. But Flickr, even that doesn't feel safe anymore. Mm-hmm. You know, even after God 8 years of photographs, thousands up there, I feel I do have local copies, but that's not the issue. It's the fact that on the web and that. The fabric of the web would be torn apart if Flickr were to close. And this, bear in mind, Flickr is owned by the same company that shut down GeoCities, once the third most visited site on the web. Thousands, millions of URLs, people's fan pages, the information, you know, genuinely valuable information. Mm-hmm. There were tens of thousands of outbound links from Wikipedia that stopped working the day that Yahoo shut down GeoCities. So you know, people get burned by this stuff. I remember Pounce particularly hurt for me, you know, because I really love Pounce.
Yeah.
It was a great service. Did you ever use Pounce then?
It was
good few years ago.
That was several years ago, yeah.
Yeah, okay. That's going backwards. It was really nice. I mean, it's funny, when Google Plus came out, I remember thinking, wow, it's really nice the way they've managed to re-implement Pounce at Google.
Isn't it? Yeah.
Pounce was the first to do the groups thing.
Right.
Mm-hmm. You know, kind of like what Google Plus did in circles. Mm-hmm. But it looked, and it was basically 2-3 people working.
Yeah.
And it was really good. And also, I should point out, I was a paid-up member. So this idea that, you know, if you pay for something, it won't go away.
Right.
Not necessarily. I had a pro Pounce account, and it still went away. And they said, we're shutting down. Here's all your data. And here's a free, because you're a pro, here's a free Vox account, because they got bought up by Six Apart. Six Apart ran Vox.
Yeah.
A year or two later, Vox shuts down, throwing away 6 or 7 million URLs.
Yeah.
Oh, and what did they say at Vox when they were shutting down?
That's great news.
No, they said, we're
really
excited. And I think you should all open up Postgres account.
Well, that one.
Well, so at some point, if you were moving your data from all these servers, at some point you'd have to stop and question, like, maybe I should host this stuff myself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think a minority of people are starting to feel that.
Yeah.
Starting to feel they want to get that solved, but of course there's real issues there. Like, what these services provide is ease of use, nice interfaces, tools, and it's still too nerdy to host your own.
Yeah,
it's still too geeky.
Yeah, I love GitHub. I think it's one of the great wonders of the web and internet. I think it's just awesome what they're doing, and I love the fact of, like, speaking of archiving. So even though if you put your content with Jekyll 5 files, easy to get, in order to post something on there, likely you'll be able to, you have to pull down a copy and have an updated copy at all times on your local machine, and then you update it and you push it up and you merge it up. So I like that type of archiving. But the degree of difficulty for someone who's just, like, you know, a regular blogger, let's say, is very high.
It is. And this is why I brought up Bastian, who makes Kerbie, because some of the stuff he's been blogging about is kind of how to solve this, how to make it easier for regular folk who aren't technical. Yeah. So he's got some plans. I think I'm going to see him later this month in Germany. We're speaking at an event, this very sort of low-key, cheap event in Germany, sort of prompted by Open Device Labs.
Do you know what the name of it?
It's called Border None.
Okay.
Border None. Geeky.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Right. I need to write a talk for that as well. But he's going to be speaking as well. So I look forward to having a chat with him. He's been writing really smart stuff.
I found that it was fairly easy to use, and I feel like it's one of those CMSs that helps educate the day-to-day blogger on why things are the way they are, and it's just beautiful and really neat.
Well, he's got more ideas about other potential tools for people.
It's all well documented, which helps a lot.
Yeah,
and that's good to explaining stuff. I saw something today actually, just browsing through some links. James Bridle was working with Mozilla on they've got like an education platform for young people. Where I can't remember what it's called, but he had done this thing. It's things called How to See Through the Cloud.
Yeah.
Which was explaining what happens when you type a URL into a browser and where it goes. And he's showing with images from Google Maps where the hops are going. Basically explaining the cloud thing is a little sort of crap. That these are cables and servers and they're physical and they have mass.
Yeah.
And they're in the world. They're not in a cloud. And I really like that. Any of those kind of things to help explain how stuff works and not have it be this obfuscated magical thing. That's why I particularly hate that term, the cloud, because it's deliberately deceitful. It's the opposite of what it's describing. Mm-hmm. It's taking something concrete and describing it as something ephemeral, like somebody else's server. It's not like a cloud, and yet you can substitute someone else's server for the word cloud anytime. And James Bridle often quotes Julian Oliver, who's spoken about this, that people tend to have a children's storybook view of the internet technology because so much of it is invisible.
Mm-hmm.
The networks around us, how this stuff works, it's invisible, so we don't have a grasp of it. Like, you ask someone to describe how the postal system works, they can give you a pretty good answer. It's like, I write a letter, it goes in the box, the postman comes. But you ask them how email works, magic, right? And when you see people, companies, deliberately trying to amplify that level of obfuscation with the cloud or magic witchcraft server stuff that you worry your little head about it, I don't think that's healthy.
Well, could you make an argument that people don't know how their cars work?
No, that's true. Well, I think you have a general grasp of the internal combustion engine is that bit in the front and gasoline goes in and works. Whereas with computers, it's like literally, or with the internet, I don't know. It's almost like we try to hide how stuff is working.
Mm-hmm.
This idea of seamlessness as a goal in design, I'm not fond of. I actually think exposing the seams is a good thing. It's kind of an honest thing, and it can be quite beautiful to show where technologies hand over to another technology, where the seams are. Making stuff appear like magic, I'm not sure is necessarily a good goal, despite Arthur C. Clarke's third law.
Yeah.
You spoke about it. I think I wasn't at the talk, but everything that I saw that people were tweeting about it was that the cloud is BS, might as well be the moon, I think was the quote.
I got a bit ranty. And yes, what I do is I mentally substitute the word moon for cloud, because then everything makes just as much sense, but it's way more entertaining.
Mm-hmm.
Like when you're in an airport and all the billboards are about cloud storage and stuff, it's like moon storage. That's way more fun.
But then you just put moon, you put Death Star, and then you're good. Yeah.
There's a
Death
plugin.
Death Star is where all the websites we used to, or the services we used to use.
There's a plugin for Chrome, and I think for Mozilla as well, that will actually do it, any instances of the cloud. There's also, for Chrome, there's a cloud to butt converter. So it will, any instances of the cloud get converted to my butt. Storage solutions for my butt.
Yeah.
Store your documents in my butt.
Yeah.
Way more entertaining. Makes just as much sense.
See, like, and I just want like a swap for TLDR. Just put it like, in summary. That's all I want. It's just like in summary. I'm tired of saying that.
TLDR, seriously. really we're pandering to people who don't have time to read the thing that click through to read.
I know. So, well, it was also this fact, like, well, I'm glad you have a summary. Call it a summary.
Call it an abstract. Call me old-fashioned, but I feel like maybe you get rewarded with the summary at the end, after you've read through the thing. Meet me halfway, people. TLDR.
Would you like someone to knock on your door and read the article to you?
Yeah.
Get that Siri working on that.
Inject it into my brain. I don't have time to read.
I'm just here to click on stuff. Just like click on stuff.
Just click all the things.
Yeah. with archiving, maybe issues with JavaScript. See, with you know, you can solve JavaScript, and then you can have like Google understand JavaScript to render pages and do all some of that. And in theory, you could have, you know, archive.org have that same spider and some of that. But then, you know, JavaScript is going to change.
Exactly. Whereas HTML has it built in that it's backwards compatible.
Right. So,
with JavaScript, I mean, generally, there is a core amount of JavaScript that absolutely will not change. Or if fairly fundamental stuff changes in JavaScript, or ECMAScript, I should say, then there'll be a switch to enable that, probably. I haven't really been keeping up with the changes in JavaScript. But you certainly couldn't rely on the fact that JavaScript from today would necessarily be parsed exactly the same in 10 years' time. Whereas you can for HTML.
Yeah.
You can absolutely rely on the backwards compatibility. It's in there by design. I was quoting an old email from Ian Hickson during my talk in the park, exactly about this, that it's not a coincidence. Like, the reason why he's documenting the way browsers parse HTML and writing a spec for how to do error handling is specifically so that for future generations, all of this knowledge that we're locking up in HTML documents be decodable, regardless of whether any browsers exist, that you could make a new browser from scratch.
Yeah.
So it's not a coincidence that HTML is backwards compatible and still adding new features. It's very much by design.
Well, yeah, and so this archiving digitization is important to me because I actually took a couple years off the web and actually was just a manager for a digitization effort of a U.S. senator's papers and his, you know, stuff. He was like, he served like one of the longest serving reps in Congress, and so he's got like a ton of paperwork from like 1910, 20s, all the way to like late 80s, and so 1980s, and so he was, you know, he was there for Social Security, he was there for Social Security reform, therefore minimum wage, and so he touched a lot of important
stuff,
U.S. policy stuff. So, so you know, I was in charge of like digitization this, and it's really amazing because I came across all this material that that we don't have the hardware to listen to it, and one of them was a magnetic wire, like a cassette tape, right?
Yeah.
Before the tape, there was a wire that was magnetic. And so we discussed whether to buy something off of eBay to listen to the speech on my neck wire.
So there's two issues. One is the format, which is what we've been talking about, HTML, you know, JSON, JavaScript, whatever. And the other is the storage medium.
Yeah.
You've got the medium and the format. And yeah, even if you can still read the format, maybe it's stored in a medium that degrades. Got wire, you got tape. And so this is an issue in a lot of industries and stuff. What worries me actually though is even when they do manage to convert the old media to digital, I worry when I see the mindset of them then thinking, well, we've solved it now.
Yeah.
Work is done. Like, you see this in the film industry because they had celluloid, which would degrade and potentially catch fire.
Yeah.
Right. Certainly isn't going to last longer than a century. So there was big digitization efforts to get it digital. And once that was done, it was like, okay, problem solved. I was like, no, now you've got two problems.
Yeah.
Now, how are you storing the digital files?
Yeah.
Is it magnetic media? Is it CDs?
Yeah.
Laser discs? You know, how are you doing that? And in what formats
is
it stored in? And are you going to have to change to new formats every 10 years?
And you have duplicates of it.
Yeah, and do you keep it
on-site, off-site?
Exactly. Yeah. That. So that the formats and the storage... That problem doesn't go away when you digitize.
Uh-huh.
That problem will persist. I mean, it's generally going to be a bit easier if it's text files, if it's stored as text files, because text files are human readable. You know, just the number of characters in them, you know, they're parsable by a human eye as well as by a machine. Whereas binary files, images, video, and so on, are completely opaque to us. They could only be read by machines. And if you lose a bit of a binary file, maybe you can't recover the whole thing, whereas you can lose a bit of text file. It's actually perfectly fine. So I get very worried, you know, particularly photography and video. Also, those are areas where historically legal restrictions have come into play. So now you got three things. You got the formats, you got the storage problem, and then you have licensing. And the worst case of all is when licensing requirements are bundled together with the format.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the euphemistically titled DRM, or Digital Rights Management, where they are actively trying to make sure that the format cannot be read in the future, that they're guaranteeing obsolescence.
Yeah.
That's the most frightening part, because formats are going to degrade anyway without adding the licensing restrictions in there. But throwing the licensing into the pot along with the storage mediums and the formats is just a recipe for disaster.
Oh, because the companies want you to buy the same copy multiple times in your lifetime.
Right, and you can understand that for the popular stuff. But what happens with that system is that all the stuff that frankly they don't care about and nobody's interested except for, you know, one or two people are just in preserving the stuff, that also gets lost.
Yeah.
And then it turns out maybe in another 50 years that is really interesting, because you don't know now what the future value of something will be. Like, you know, some service shuts down today, Posterous or Tumblr or something like that, announces it's shutting down, they're really excited, you know, incredible journey. And you think, well, whatever, it was just a bunch of, you know, teenagers blogging their angst or something. It's not important. It's not valuable information. But if one of those teenagers is a future president of the United States, then that becomes historically valuable in the future. And there's no way to predict, right, that the Pounce account of the first woman to walk on Mars is already lost to us, right? You can't tell the future value of something. So with the studios and publishers saying, you know, we want to hold on to this stuff, they generally only care about a small fraction, the stuff that makes them money.
Yeah.
And there's this whole long tail of stuff that, frankly, they don't care about, but they have to protect because they can't make exceptions. Right? It's got to be an all or nothing situation. And this is why, well, you know, in the 20th century, we've seen copyright law extended to ridiculous levels. So Lawrence Lessig had a brilliant idea, and it did make it as far as the Supreme Court, and he lost, unfortunately, which was you have a copyright term that's reasonable. You know, copyright used to be 17 years, and it was, you know, lifetime of author and all this, and now it's effectively perpetuity. Because as soon as Mickey Mouse is coming up for entering the public domain, they lobby to get it extended. It's just going to be copyright in perpetuity. Just that, have copyright for a reasonable amount of time. I don't know, 20, 25 years, whatever.
Mm.
And at that point, if you want to extend your copyright, you pay one penny, you know, to extend it for another 25 years, whatever. Or your estate, maybe your debt, your estate pays a penny to get it extended. But if you don't care, or you don't even know anymore about this work, it just lapses into the public domain. I thought that was a brilliant, brilliant proposal. That would please everyone, because that would please the studios too.
Right.
They would just pay their pennies and you know, a
dollar
nominal amount.
Yeah,
just something that basically just says, yes, I want to extend it.
Yeah.
Brilliant idea, but maybe ahead of its time.
Yeah, and then he's actually suing.
Oh yes,
a company for YouTube because
fair use.
Yeah, fair use because he in his presentation he uses a video. That someone made, like a fan video of, I forgot what the song is, but he has Breakfast Club clips inside of this music video, and he uses in his presentation fair use, you know, just critiquing.
It's like it's a demonstration of fair use.
Yeah, and then he got a robo email from YouTube saying to take it down.
So it's the perfect test case. It's the perfect one to go to court with.
Yeah, and
really looking forward to the results of that.
Yeah, well, not only that, he said, no, I'm using fair use, and they relented. I'm not sure how long the discussion took place, but they relented, and now he's actually going after them and saying, no, you're actually using copyright law wrong because you're just blindly looking and just saying, if you're using my song, therefore it's bad. You're not looking at what's actually happening, so you're not.
Oh, I got DMCA takedown notices for sites I run that just happened to have a string of text in there that was similar to a string that some guy is just, you know, doing a Google search, sucking back thousands of documents and sending Google a DMCA takedown notice for thousands of URLs, which Google then blindly follows. But to be fair, Google will inform you, and Google will post a request on chillingeffects.org so you can see. But yeah, people are completely abusing the DMCA and using it like a machine gun, just a scattergun approach.
Yeah.
Take it all down, which is illegal. If you were to go after them and say, you in good faith, you know, did not know that was infringing, and yet you sent that, you know, you could be punished for doing that.
Yeah, is automation good faith?
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, anyway, back to the licensing issue and studios and stuff. It's it adds in just one more factor that makes this part of our history, and I mean our history in terms of the human race, kind of fragile, that we may end up having this great big digital memory hole.
Right.
You know, at the end of the 20th century, start of the 21st century, but we're still figuring stuff out.
Yeah, you have like I saw a telegram from Dizzy Arnaz to this representative. Like, I'm like actually holding it in my hand, like with gloves, right? I'm like, oh my gosh, like, oh my God. And that's a piece of history. Like, you know, I'll never hold an email like that, you know, in my hands. It's, you know.
The telegraph is a fantastic invention. And there was initially, one of the telegraph operators here in the U.S. were thinking that maybe they did need to store every single telegram that was ever sent, which is, I think they tried for a while, didn't really scale. But there's a terrific book by Tom Standage called The Victorian Internet. Uh-huh. Highly recommend it. It's about the telegraph. And you realize what a world-changing technology it was. More world-changing than the web. And I'm a huge fan of the web, as you know. But what the web has done, or what the internet has done as well, email and other internet tools, is accelerated things, and it's made, you know, it's collapsed geographic distance. But it's allowed us to do stuff we were already doing, but do it faster, do it better, do it more efficiently. Whereas the telegraph actually kind of fundamentally changed the world. It changed how people viewed the world, how people thought of distance, how people thought of time. You know, the War of 1812, the Battle of New Orleans, was fought after a peace treaty had already been signed in Kent, right? They didn't know that news hadn't traveled. Whereas by the end of that century, in the Crimean War, people are opening their newspapers and getting reports of what happened on the battlefield, you know, from the day before. There's this ridiculous change in this conception of the world, and the laying of the transatlantic cable, you know, epochal change in mankind. And it's anyway, I could geek out about the telegraph. I'm fascinated by it.
Yeah.
The Victorian Internet by Tom Standage is pretty terrific.
Okay.
Yeah.
Check that out. So that kind of brings me up as like, because like I bring up the telegraph because like, I didn't know anything about this representative before I took a job. I just walked in there. I learned so much about American history by physical media that didn't need electricity, except for the stuff like, you know, magnetic wire, you know, and VHS tapes. But, you know, there's papers. There's tons of papers and actually go through it. And now that our news is like, I can't find news articles I want in 2001 because CNN hadn't really got on their game yet in its whole transition. But
most libraries have coverage of the Kennedy assassination, but not the Obama inauguration.
Yeah.
Because of the media, because of rights restrictions, all of that stuff.
So that gets me to the point of like NSA and how awesome it is that they're copying the internet.
It's fantastic. We've all got backups.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So
if only they'd released them.
Yeah. And actually, there's actually court cases, which I'm pretty sure they were destined for failure, is that like people were being sued and they're actually petitioning NSA.
Yeah, yeah. To prove.
To prove like the internet because they have a copy of some email or whatever.
Yeah. And my alibi is I sent this email, you know.
Yeah.
You can prove it by just getting the NSA to verify.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
So. But,
you could start a new branch at the NSA.
Customer support.
Yeah.
Well,
that'll go over well.
Let me just pull that up for you. But yeah, the digitization thing of having, you know, analog stuff, trying to get that digital, that happens in a lot of fields. I was talking to a physicist last week. He was at Slack down in Stanford, the particle accelerator, which is, I believe, it was the second web server ever in the world. Was it Slack? And they've got the, you know, data from experiments going back decades, but you know, it's in old formats. Maybe it's digital, but it's stored on some medium they can't get hold of.
And,
it's really worrying. You know, he was asking me about this. You know, is it safe to throw some of this stuff away? But then I was pointing out you don't know the future value of past data. On the plus side, we got Moore's law, so storage should just get cheaper and cheaper and cheaper.
Yeah.
But it doesn't solve the medium problem. It doesn't solve the format problem. You know, how is it stored? And again, same with NASA. They've got stuff from the 60s from the Apollo program that they can't read because of the format it's in, because of the medium that it's in. The main thing with all of this stuff, and you know, whether it's NASA or physicists or film or politics or people just posting stuff to a third party service on Postgres or Pants or whatever. The main thing is to realize the problem exists.
Yeah.
It's easy to get very hopeless about this and like, oh, it's an overwhelming problem. But actually, the biggest issue is just acknowledging the problem exists.
Right.
Because by far the most insidious sort of virus that's spread culturally is this meme that the internet never forgets.
Yeah.
People say it like a truism.
Yeah.
They say it like it's unquestioned. Everyone knows the internet never forgets.
Yeah.
Be careful what you put online, because once it's up there, it never goes away.
Right.
Again, it's like the cloud. That is the complete opposite of what the data shows us.
Mm-hmm.
Like the average lifespan of a web page is months.
Yeah.
The stuff disappears all the time. The internet forgets all the time. The idea that, oh, Google will never forget and Facebook will never forget, you know, I would not rely on that. The idea that, you know, they'll never go away, they're too big to fail. And like I said, GeoCities was the third most visited site on the web. That's gone.
Well, like, and people are publishing so much on the web, you know, it becomes critical. But also, as that becomes cheaper, printing becomes more expensive.
Yeah.
And so it's actually like, I see like a lot of bands will make, especially the bigger bands will make a specialized, you know, LPs, you know, vinyl and some of that, as well as special books to go along with their albums. And I find, you know, for fans and collectors to buy, and I find those really interesting, because it's like they're trying to upsell you for one, but also if you're like, wow, you're actually making a Polaroid or
and
a
I see,
snapshot that doesn't need electricity. Like
the retro thing. I get it, and I actually see web people doing the same thing. Like people who are, you know, confronting the mortality of their digital works and realizing, oh, that first website I built is gone, long gone.
Yeah.
And so they start making magazines or screen prints. You know, I see a lot of designers doing this. They say, oh, I started a new magazine about typography, or I'm starting, I'm making craft beer or coasters or whatever. And so I understand that need as a reaction to the perceived impermanence of digital. But I also feel like it's a bit of a cop-out.
Yeah.
I feel like it's running away from the problem and saying, oh, you know what? Preserving this digital stuff is hard. Let's go shopping. Let's go making. Right?
It's looking back in the past.
It's just turning away. It's turning away from the problem and saying, I can't figure out how to solve the problem of the stuff I build online disappearing. So I'm not even going to try. I'm going to make a nice print magazine instead.
Mm-hmm.
It's not confronting the problem.
Yeah.
It's running away from it. Although, you know, people are free to do whatever they want. But then it kind of reinforces the idea that this is an unsolvable problem, which I don't believe it is, because like I said, I think the biggest first step is acknowledging the problem even exists. And if more people did that, and if more people did question, you know, when a service or a whatever company says, oh, it's online, it's all fine, that they push back and say, well, tell me more. Mm. Just saying something is online is not good enough.
Right.
You know, tell me your plans for 5 years, 10 years. Tell me how the data is stored, what format it's in, what medium it's in.
Right.
That if people started doing that more, started questioning more, they wouldn't be so shocked when, you know, services shut down and take their data with them.
Yeah, and even like kind of rule of thumb is like if the user service that's free, then you are the...
Yeah, except, like
content.
I said, I was
but
paying
then, for
but you're,
accounts. Yeah,
yeah.
So even then, it comes...
Yeah, even then.
Yeah. So it's definitely like own your own space.
Or at the very least, go in with your eyes open.
Yeah.
Understand that when you give something to a third party, there's no guarantee that, you know, it's there forever or they will get it back to you.
If that one line was just the terms and conditions, I feel like people would actually read that.
Keep your eyes open.
We
make no guarantee.
Yeah, jump feet first.
Yeah. Awesome. You know, it's interesting because you were talking about, you know, Independence Day and all that stuff. Like, this, we used to do this. If we wanted to put something online, we put it online.
Yeah.
Didn't ask for anyone's permission. You know, we just put it online, make our own website.
Yeah.
And yeah, it's a bit geeky because you have to know how to put something, you know, FTP something to a server, buy a domain name, all that. But it was the norm. Right?
Yeah.
That was the norm, was you published on your own site. And it was, you know, cool new sites came along where you could publish to those sites. Like Flickr came along and all that. And that was cool. But still, the norm was you published on your own site. I kind of see a whole generation where their norm is publishing on a third-party site.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
There was a, what's that site, Branch, opened up a while back, where you kind of have conversations. I've never tried it out because it asks write permissions to my Twitter account, which it doesn't need, so I refuse to give it. And I encourage everyone else to be very wary of what services they give write permissions to.
You like to post your Facebook
thing. But anyway, so the young guy running it, he started a thread because he was genuinely curious why people wouldn't just post a Branch.
Because
some people were saying, well, I'll write this on my own site. He was genuinely curious, which I really respected, that he wanted to know why would you feel that way, because surely all all we do all the time is post to third-party sites because he'd grown up with MySpace and then Facebook and then Twitter.
Yeah.
That's all he'd ever known.
Yeah.
And so there was some more old-school bloggers like Anil Dash and Gina Trapani are explaining, well, it's about owning the data or like it being your decision, you know, when it gets destroyed rather than the third-party decision.
Right. So it's like how paper is like an upsell or a value add. Running your own blog is now like, weird, that's awesome. That's
crazy. Yeah. Well, this is the thing. So the whole indie web movement, you know, we get together at these indie web camps. We're like this weird extremist group. You know? So like the radical idea that you would own your own website and publish to your own website is like, that's crazy talk.
Yeah.
But yeah, you remember, it used to be the norm, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I mean, that was the normal way of doing it.
Yeah.
I got a question for you, Chris, on digital preservation stuff.
What's that?
Where's High Five?
That is a good question. You're not the first one to ask me that, but Greg Story is on my case. He's runs Chicago Austin, and so I'm glad you asked. That makes me feel warm fuzzies inside. So.
High Five, you know, when I was first getting online, learning to be a web designer, High Five was terrific.
Oh man, thanks. It's speaking of archiving, it is on a zip disk.
It's
sitting on a zip disk. I saved it. It's also on a CD-ROM somewhere. I have to go find it. So I told Greg, he's like, it's in a box.
You got
storage
unit.
So yeah, it's
it would give me such warm fuzzies.
Yeah, I mean, it's you have no idea. Like I don't know. I feel like for people who don't know, High Five was started by Dan Siegel, and he hired people like I was like the third producer, I think, after two others and something. And it was just every week we would either interview a designer, critique a website. I think every week we critique a website, and then we'd have some other feature going on at the same time. So it's
a real magazine style, right? Every issue had its own kind of look and feel.
Yeah, and
do you know about this, Sam?
No.
This is a piece of web history.
So Greg's on me, and actually, but he's actually offered to hire people to go look through my stuff to go find it.
Great.
Now that you're on my back about it, I'll make more effort to get it. But I was just thinking like while we're talking, like I'll just find that dang thing and just put it on GitHub, and then slowly we'll convert to Jekyll or something like that, and we'll just branch it, and the original file will still be in the master branch upload first one. So if you want to go back to the original,
it would be like the opposite of .NET Magazine.
Yes,
you're restoring this great magazine from over 10 years ago.
Yeah, but High Five was before Blogger.
Yeah,
before.
Before
anything. You have no idea how much, if I had WordPress back then, how much High Five would be different. Most of my time was producing. It was actually production
writing,
of it. Not just interviewing people, but it was just like
writing HTML.
I
remember there was High Five and Zeldman had Ask Dr. Web.
Yes.
And WebMonkey was around by then.
Yes.
That was how I learned.
Yeah, WebMonkey.
Yeah. Which, did that just get taken?
Yeah, but sort of quietly.
So the monkey fell off
the web recently.
Yeah, well, we should talk about .NET Magazine, which I felt like they were, Oliver is part of the team there. I'm not sure the organizational chart, but I know he's,
big editor-in-chief.
Yeah, and so I felt like they were kind of like, .NET Magazine is a different, organization. And then, but I felt so they're slowly merging the two in terms of visual identity.
Right, with Creative Block.
Block. And so they just moved everything from the .NET brand over to Creative Block.
Not everything.
I think 500 articles.
Yeah, the top 500, which is great. Great editorial choice is to look at stats and just go for that, not for the...
I mean, I want to give them the credit,
Benefit
of the doubt, and I know they're good people.
Oh, they're awesome people.
They handled it really badly.
Yeah.
And it was just suddenly sprung on everyone.
Oh, yeah.
And then they also brought up licensing issues, right? They don't necessarily have the rights to, throw it all up on GitHub or something.
Oh, yeah. That's right, yeah.
And, there's not many people working on it, blah, blah, blah. But it was handled pretty badly. And I think more than that, it's kind of going to have a bad effect on their trust in the community.
Yeah.
The next time somebody's asked to write an article for them.
Yeah.
Like, well, why would I write an article for you? Who knows when it'll disappear.
And I thought they were chugging along and doing great. They were like having a great brand.
Well, this is the weird thing. Creative Block is not something I consider, as this, authoritative place on the web, whereas .NET was kind of becoming that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And yet they decided to, if anything, I would imagine merging Creative Block with .NET, not the other way around.
Right.
Maybe I'm seeing it from a skewed perspective.
Or keep from the same keep them the same. I keep their own identities separate.
Keep them separate.
Yeah, and then just link back and forth and have a field day with that. So we're not there.
We don't know the whole story. So I don't want to. Yeah. I don't want to be pointing the finger and saying fail, like exactly the stuff I was decrying earlier.
Yeah,
I don't want to be that guy.
So definitely rule is own your own stuff. So
I mean, I've published articles on other sites, but then I republished them on the Dactio.
Yeah, that's fine.
Which, when you did that for the pastry box project, one, that was the first time I'd ever seen that. I posted this here, and I think the conversation was about self-publishing, too.
everyone should write. Everyone should write on, share what they're doing, et cetera.
Yeah.
So, of course, I'm going to post it to my own site as well. I was writing an article recently for a new magazine that's coming along, and I just made it clear that I'm going to want to publish this on my own site.
Yeah.
They're cool with that. It was after a little grace period, I think, agree on a week or 2 weeks or something, and then so I usually consider the canonical copy to be the one that's on my own site.
Yeah.
If that disappears, it'll be my own fault.
Yeah,
I can't blame anyone else then. I usually publish transcripts of talks as well. If talks are recorded, I get them transcribed and publish them there, just so that there's a searchable, a findable version of the talk, rather than having it locked up in binary formats.
Right.
Third-party server.
Yeah, it's about accessibility. Like, that's sad, and that's one of the things we have to catch up on at Numbering Spaces, transcribing all our backlog and stuff.
Well, here's the thing. I don't necessarily think it needs to be only your problem. So, like I said, I transcribe my talks at a conference.
Right.
I haven't done it recently, but I encourage other speakers, if this talk's been recorded, to get their talk transcribed.
Yeah.
And that way, the onus isn't on the conference organizer to transcribe,
right,
10, 20 talks, which is a lot of work. It's like one person transcribed one talk.
Yeah.
The talk you gave. And then suddenly the workload is distributed.
Yeah.
And I do feel it with podcasts as well. It's like it's a lot of onus on the podcasters to transcribe every single episode.
Yeah.
But maybe if you have some way of dividing that up, of having a team of people, or maybe it's sponsored or something like that.
Yeah.
But I know it's a lot of pressure on a very small group of people to try and transcribe everything.
Right.
And whenever I see that pattern of like, there's so much pressure on one particular bottleneck, I try and look for ways to spread that. Because that's what the web's great at. I mean, that's what the web was made for, is collaboration.
Right.
So any opportunity to say, is there a way we can do this in a more wiki-like manner, or GitHub-like way of doing things, where the huge advantage is collaboration and not having one person be a bottleneck.
Yeah, well, I think I heard one podcast, like back in the day, several years now, is that they throw a podcast and then all their fans would do like a line here and there on the wiki page, and then just slowly they would have it right there.
I ended up doing something like that for a talk. So normally I have a professional transcriber, but I was curious whether that model would work. So I just put the call on Twitter, who would be interested in transcribing. I think I said 10 minutes of audio. So once I have, six people for an hour-long talk, good. In retrospect, I think 5 minutes is plenty. 10 minutes is actually quite a lot.
Yeah.
But did that, kind of spliced it together. Everyone came back with their 5 minutes.
Yeah.
Or maybe I could do double blind and have two people do every 5 minutes, and then if one of them is late with it, it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Or run a diff as a way of finding typos or something. But yeah, that another way of spreading the work around.
Use Siri.
Yes.
Oh man.
It'll change all the rooms.
And I guess, we've talked all the time, but I do want to talk about, I have absolutely no idea what you're doing in CERN. So please let us know.
I could tell you, but I have to kill you.
Oh, man, okay. Well, let's just keep on going.
No,
it's about the God particle, right?
Yeah. I've discovered the fundamental nature of my... No, it was this really fundamental. Let me see. Let me back up.
Okay.
Let me back up. I was in CERN last year, actually, for a visit. It was semi-work related, but mostly it was just an excuse to go to CERN.
Yeah.
Got to see the Atlas experiment. I was just in seventh heaven. Because first of all, I'm a science geek,
right,
and it's like the greatest experiment ever in the history of our species, and that's magnificent. And also, it's where the web was born.
Mm-hmm.
That's a huge web geek. So I was absolutely thrilled. And then I met up with Mark Bolton, and he sort of took me aside, knowing I'm big into digital preservation and URLs and all of this, to tell me that, because he's working with CERN, on the website, one of the projects they're doing internally was restoring the very first web page to its original URL, Tim Berners-Lee's first website, first ever web server, which I was just like, oh, that's brilliant. Like, that's everything coming full circle.
Yeah.
Yes, that was fantastic. He was so excited. And then later, so they did that. and that was fantastic. They've written about it on the CERN blog. It was great. Later, it took me aside and told me about another project they were planning, kind of along those lines. Again, trying to drive home the history of the web and its importance. To recreate one of the early web browsers, not the world's first web browser, because that was World Wide Web, but that only ran on the next machine. But the first web browser that could run on multiple systems, which was a huge boost to explaining the web or showing the power of it. To recreate that in a modern browser, so that you'd go to a URL and you could experience what it was like to use this line mode browser, which was very primitive because it was text only. You couldn't click on links. You had to type in everything. But you could browse hypertext. So Mark then asked if I'd be involved in organizing an event like that because, you know, I organized Science Hack Day a few years ago, and at Clear Left we have these hack farms we do every year, which, you know, involves hacking on something for a week. And so I've had some experience of being involved in these kind of gatherings. So what we decided to do is we gathered together about a dozen people, 10, 12 people, make half of them sort of invited experts, people that we know their skill sets would definitely be useful, and the other half people could apply. So that's what we did. You know, I sort of put the call out to people. I thought, oh, we got to have this. You know, Remy Sharp, got to have him. And, and also Leah Veru, we need someone who could really kick ass at CSS. Like, you know, put the bat signal into the sky for Leah Veru, because she's really awesome. And then, you know, allowed people to apply for the other positions. We got terrific people. Like, there was Martin was from Kenya, and Angela was from France. Yeah, people from all over. Mm-hmm. That was just terrific. So a bunch of people from all over the world. John Alsop came from Australia.
Wow.
Craig Maud applied, and he got through. Brian LaRue. Mm-hmm. So just terrifically smart people. And we get together at CERN. So first of all, we're just all geeking out.
Right.
And now we get to have this Hack Day project to recreate this clunky old browser in a modern browser. And first thing we're there, they wheel in this old IBM machine they've unearthed from a computer museum in Lausanne, which was running the old line mode browser. So it's like this machine from 1990, I guess. And it still worked.
Oh, wow.
You could turn it on, and you could feel like the clunkiness of the keyboard. And, you know, how the typeface looked in that raster screen. That was actually really, really good. That really helped us figure out, you know, what the experience was we're trying to recreate. So it was just a lot of fun. I mean, on one hand, it's just a really silly little project, right? You know, recreating this thing. It's just some crazy stuff. So Brian Suda is trying to figure out, Brian and Mark, they're font geeks. They're looking at the font in this old machine. It's like, what is this? Light Courier, it's a monospace font, but look at the L's, they're kind of curly. What is this? And they couldn't figure out what it was. So they figured it was some system font that just, you know, no longer exists.
Right.
So Brian types every character on the keyboard,
takes
a photograph of the screen.
Oh, he sends it to the web?
No, he imports it into Illustrator.
Okay.
He makes a font over the course of the hack event. He makes a new font.
That's awesome.
So it's now on GitHub.
Yeah.
And John Alsop recorded the sound of the keys being typed like that clunky. So when if you go to the line mode browser simulator, you can go to line-mode.cern.ch and click on the button to launch it. As you type, you'll get the noises. And this is ridiculous animation, because it has stuff gets drawn on the screen. It's all very silly. But when it was done, we were actually, you know, browsing around the very first website using this machine. It was something to it. It was quite immersive. It really did feel like you were experiencing what it was like at the time. Oh, and what was really just not so at the beginning of it, first day, we get a little pep talk from Robert Caillou, who's co-creator of the World Wide Web, Tim Berners-Lee's manager at the time, who was quite a character, and telling us about, you know, what it was like then, and you know, also ranting about all the things he wished had gone differently after that, but he's fascinating. And actually, just recently on the flight over, because I need a book for takeoff and landing when I'm not allowed to use my electronic devices. I've been rereading Weaving the Web by Tim Berners-Lee, or maybe ghostwritten Tim Berners-Lee. And there I'm reading about exactly this time and exactly this place. He's describing the place, you know, the corridors we were walking down. So it was just a fantastic little event. I didn't contribute that much to the line mode browser itself, but we also kind of had a storytelling side explaining, what are we doing here? What was the line mode browser? And most of my contributions were words, just writing that, a bit of image optimization, that kind of stuff. And then the second day, we get taken on a tour. we get go down into the Large Hadron Collider and we get a tour of the LHCb experiment.
Oh, that's crazy.
Crazy Hungarian physicists describing how the detectors work. And that was just terrific.
Those were the pictures of you with the hard hats.
Yes.
And all that.
Yeah, all those pictures look ridiculous because I'm wearing my future-friendly t-shirt, which has a helmet on it,
yeah.
And then I have a helmet on my head. So it's like all the helmets in every picture.
Oh, yeah.
But it was just a terrific experience, and I'm really pleased with what we did in such a short space of time.
Yeah.
You know, I say we, I really did. You know, Remy and Brian LaRue were the doing the hardcore Node.js, you know, parsing and stuff. But there was some really interesting stuff came out of that. So I blogged this recently. There was some decisions we made. Like, so entities just showed up, like ampersand shows up on the screen. That's deliberate because that browser would not have parsed those named entities. Also, there's a lot of websites you go to using this 9-mode browser, and the first thing you see is a bunch of JavaScript output to the screen. Like maybe your type Fontec JavaScript appears at the top. We deliberately didn't hide that. We deliberately show that because that's what would have happened.
Right.
JavaScript didn't exist. The script element didn't exist. And as we were saying earlier, if a browser sees an element that doesn't exist, it ignores it and just shows the content,
right?
Which reminded me, and you'll remember this too, Chris, when we wrote JavaScript back in the day,
yeah,
we used to always begin with the comment,
yeah,
with the HTML comment,
yeah,
which is allowed at the beginning of a JavaScript file, so that it wouldn't be output to the screen
right,
of the browser. And at some point we stopped doing that, which is fair enough, because it's not a great practice. But it suddenly brought it back. I hadn't thought about that in years.
Oh, yeah.
How we used to comment our JavaScript, you know. And then for XHTML, it was the C data.
Yeah,
it was
like the weird, funky string.
A bunch of strings, incantations we put in our JavaScript. So it was bringing back all this stuff. It was really, really, really fun.
Yeah. I'm just glad we have JavaScript source now. And
Because
those comments really just threw me for a loop.
Yeah.
It's like, I'm putting HTML comments in my document.
Yeah, it was weird.
Yeah. You do great blog posts, you do great presentations, and I just want to ask, what goes into, you know, we're at EventApart, Austin, and you've been speaking at EventApart for a while, and just we've been asking this of Spool and Cameron Green and stuff like that, just like, how do you go about preparing for a presentation?
Panic,
okay.
Fear.
How long does that usually last?
Months of
until the presentation's over.
So what happens is, you know, EventApart, whatever, will ask me to speak, which is, you know, a huge honor. But they'll be asking me, like, maybe a year in advance, because, you know, they kind of plan it. And they ask me for talk title and description, you know, well ahead of time. And I'm thinking, I don't know what I'm going to talk about.
Yeah, it feels like South by, in a way, because, like, South by just wrapped up their call for papers, and they're just voting or whatever. And it was just like, we're still, like,
know?
Six,
yeah.
9 months out. I don't understand.
So I send back the vaguest talk title and the vaguest description I can come up with.
And goodbye.
So this one was like, the long web. And it's, I don't know, it's like, the web, what's that all about? so that I could basically write anything and make it fit the vague description. I think last year's talk was the spirit of the web. You know, so I'm like, well, that could be anything, so I'll be safe. Don't tell Jeffrey this.
It's you won't
just
hear this.
Okay, it's between you and me.
Yeah, no one's going to know.
Yeah.
And then I panic for months and think about it. And I pace a lot, a lot of pacing. My wife recognizes now when I'm doing a talk, because she notices I'm pacing up and down. She's like, you're preparing a talk in your head, aren't you? And then I do exactly what you're not supposed to do. So it's like writing. In writing, there's this idea of, you know, shitty first drafts, where what you got to do is just dump everything down onto the page and then go back and edit.
Yeah.
Because it's much easier to write than edit than it is to write and edit at the same time.
Oh my gosh, yes.
Right. So you shouldn't be, you know, slaving over every line you're going to bring. I know that. I know that intellectually. I know that, you know, but I can't do it.
Yeah.
When I'm writing, I'm like, no, actually, I'm going to start writing. It's the worst thing to do. And with talks, it's kind of similar. What I should be doing is, you know, getting down the broad brushstrokes on paper or something, and then, you know, going back and moving around. And instead, I'm kind of just got all this stuff going around in my mind, which is the worst place for it, right? You actually need to get it down onto paper or post-it notes. And at some point, I will, like, you know, just do a brain dump, maybe onto the wall with post-it notes. But when I then open up Keynote, I don't know.
Something happens.
I don't know, maybe, yeah, I kind of know what I want to say as I'm putting the Keynote together. Okay, so let me. What I think is the biggest challenge of a good talk, but also kind of one of the most important points, in my opinion, is crafting a good narrative. Because what you're doing is you're telling a story, ideally, because that's what people pay attention to. As human beings, we're wired to enjoy stories, to pay attention to stories. We're not really wired to listen to facts or enumerated, you know, bullet lists of items. So you need to find a way to take what's essentially enumerated bullet list of items and turn it into a story, turn it into something that's got narrative. And that's a challenge because sometimes I'll have these topics that I want to cover, both of them, in the same talk, and I have to think, how do I get from here to here? How do I get from A to B? What's the thread?
Right.
What's the segue there? And those joining those things up, I think, is the really hard bit. I guess maybe it's like screenwriting or something. Like, how does the character get from the hotel downtown to the ship or something, right? So I find myself spending a lot of time on that, but that then pays off because ideally people don't notice that. It's just like you're carrying them along in the story. So I tend not to like talks where it's, you know, 10 things about X, thing one. And now they've given you the structure at the beginning.
Right.
So there's no sense of mystery, there's no sense of threat, there's no sense of surprise because you know that what's coming next is thing two.
Yeah.
And probably three after that. And you know how long you have to go because we're at number 7 and you said at the start of the number could be 10. There's a lot of advice out there about giving talks. It seems quite outdated to me, like the whole thing of where you get up and say who you are and why you should be giving this talk. I'm like, what? No, that's a terrible idea. Just get straight down to it. They can read the program.
Yeah.
And then it's like, say what you're going to say it, and then say what you said, right?
This the three-times approach.
Right, like, three times is what you learn that in college, I guess. Like, so no, it's like, spoilers, you're giving away the whole plot ahead of time, and then you're boring them at the end by recapping what you just did.
Right.
It's like, no, for me, it's about making a narrative, and I find it really hard to do that.
Yeah.
But if I can get it, it's really rewarding, because and then I can take people and cover a range of topics that pretty unconnected, but I found a way to connect them.
Right.
It's like, do you ever see that old TV show Connections with James Burke?
No.
It was very webby. It was kind of very hyperlinky in its way. It used to be on PBS in the States. It's an English show. But he would do that way of connecting these apparently completely unconnected events in history or in science or something. And there's a real pleasure to that somehow, of like drawing the links between the stuff. It's kind of like hypertext in a way. So some of my favorite blog posts, you know, from other people or ones I've written have been ones that join together things that maybe weren't previously connected.
Yeah.
Like I'm linking to something over here, which reminds me of this thing over here, and also, you know, this third thing, which nobody's thought about as being connected to those two other things. And then the blog post is kind of something new because it's connected stuff together. So I hope when I'm putting the talk together that I managed to, you know, connect a bunch of different stuff. I'm always pretty convinced that my talks are basically just rambling collections of unconnected stuff, often stuff I just want to rant about, which happens, you know, over the course of the talk. Also, I generally don't prepare, you know, word for word what I'm going to say. I have actually done that occasionally where I've written out the entire talk and presented it that way, maybe 3-4 times ever. For a specific kind of talk, certainly not a developer talk or design talk. It would be maybe more big thinky concept talk. But generally what I try and do is have beats. Like, I know I'm going to talk about this now for a minute or two, and then I'm going to talk about this for a minute or two once I've got my segue. But I won't have written down exactly what I'm going to say. And sometimes I get surprised by what comes out of my mouth, or sometimes I don't even realize what I've said, and then when the talk's done, I read Twitter, and I'm like, I said what? I don't remember saying that.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, that sounds terrible, or that sounds great.
Yeah.
What I'll do is I'll put in my notes where I expect I should be time-wise.
Yeah.
So by a certain, you know, number of slides in, I'll just have a note to myself saying 10 minutes, ? Or later on 20 minutes, ? And the point there is that if I'm reach that point where I'm supposed to be around 10 minutes, and actually I'm 5 minutes, then I know I can pad, I can, you know, I can take my time and talk. But if it's supposed to be 10 minutes and it's already 15 minutes, I know I need to speed it up. And why I do that throughout is so that what you don't end up with is right at the end, you know, so, oh crap, I've still got 20 more slides to cover in 2 minutes.
Yeah.
Or the opposite, where, oh no, I'm 2 minutes from the end of my presentation and there's a half an hour left of of time. So by having those beats throughout, I kind of adjust accordingly. And I'll kind of be looking and think, oh, yeah, I've got time for a good rant now. I can rant about something here for a bit. Or I'm going to skip straight over the rant I could do and jump to the next point or something.
And do you have these rants just, like, just pre-made and ready to roll on any time or just...
That's basically nothing to do with public speaking. That's just me. That's just, yes, I'm full of rant. I know, I think people have this idea of me as being quite an angry person, which I'm not, but I can understand if that impression were given, because certain subjects I'll get quite ranty about, but I can't help it.
And does have you always been a writer, or has your blog helped you at all?
It's taken me a long time to get comfortable with calling myself a writer, because it's like, I'm not a writer. Writers write. I don't write. Yeah. You know, people write. But, you know, for writing the blog, and that's not real writing, but it's writing. Yeah. And then the book and all that, even then, you know, obviously it felt like a complete fake, because, you know, I don't write books. People who write books.
Yeah.
But after a while, I sort of realized, you know what? People are enjoying what I'm writing, or I get a pleasure out of writing something sometimes. I'm like, oh, that felt quite good.
Yeah.
That felt satisfying. Why shouldn't I call myself a writer? And also, sometimes I would read quote-unquote professional writing and think, this is really bad.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of journalism is not good writing. Or a lot of popular, you know, books, fiction and nonfiction, is I read and I go, I think I can call myself a writer. If this is, you know, and I've really grown to appreciate good writers, good communicators, even if they aren't necessarily the most knowledgeable in their subject.
Right.
I've come to realize that that's not what's important. So in web terms, you could be the best JavaScript in the world, you could be the best person with CSS, that does not mean you're going to be able to explain it well.
Right.
When I wrote DOM scripting, you know, it's very much for people beginning JavaScript. That's because I was beginning JavaScript.
Mm-hmm.
I could relate to that. When Andy Budd was learning CSS, he wrote what he was learning. And I remember thinking, because I'd done CSS years before, I remember seeing his blog posts and thinking, oh, why would you write that? That seems kind of obvious to me. And of course, it wasn't obvious. I'd just forgotten what it was like not to know that stuff.
Yeah.
So he would get comments, people going, this is great. I'm so glad you wrote this.
Right.
I was like, oh. So Andy kind of became established as a CSS expert and wrote the book, CSS Mastery, not because he learned CSS and then wrote about it, but because he wrote about it as he was learning.
Yeah.
So this idea that viewpoint is actually really, really important. I've just figured this out. Here's what I figured out. And sure, maybe you'll get somebody on the internet, you know, on Twitter, and a comment will go, yeah, that's obvious. What's the point of writing this? And, you know, screw them, basically.
Yeah.
Because there's equally, there's 10, 20 people who go, thank you for writing this. This is great. And people like me or other people who maybe we knew that stuff and we wouldn't have thought of writing it.
Yeah.
We wouldn't have thought that this was something that should have been written down,
yeah.
which was a mistake, you know, on our part, that we missed this. So the ability to communicate clearly, whether it's writing or speaking, I've come to really appreciate. I remember I read a lot of popular science books. I was reading the biography of Nikola Tesla. It was absolutely fascinating. His life story is just inherently interesting. And it was the dullest book. I was like, how did this person manage to take something so interesting and make it so dull? So I have a really appreciation for people like... you know, Stephen Johnson or even Malcolm Gladwell, where, you know, he gets a lot of stick, but, you know, the ability to make it interesting and make it appealing to a mass market is in some ways more important than, you know, being the most knowledgeable or, you know, you hope that it's accurate at least, but it doesn't necessarily have to be, you know, backed up with reams of data and made boring.
Yeah.
So I'm hoping that over the years that's where my sort of leaning has gone, is more in explaining stuff.
Yeah.
Not being the best at stuff, not by a long shot, but in maybe communicating how stuff works in an accessible manner.
Mm-hmm.
And that's generally what I'm trying to do in my talks. It's generally I'm trying to get some concepts across. Not that they're tricky concepts, but just trying to make them accessible to people.
Yeah, like you said, like you know, people, we've been in the industry for a while, and so when people like write a blog post explaining something that we think is basic, I'm like, what? Like, oh, exactly. And I was at Comic-Con, and DCU's comics was wiping out all their characters and starting fresh again. And people were like, what the hell are you doing with that? You know, like, you know, all these fogies who have been, like, collecting comics forever, right? You know, like me. And it was just, and they said, like, you know, the next issue is going to be someone's first issue. Like, not that it's number one, but, like, like if it's number 12 issue, it's going to be their first issue. We need to have characters that are, you know, in their language, if you will.
Where they don't need to go and study for...
Right. Yeah. And one of the examples was, like, you know, the 1950s, you know, with Sputnik and the UFO crashing, you know, whatever. Like, I don't think it was a big deal. But, you know, the whole rocket ship ray gun type things was commonplace, and so you had a lot of villains still in the DC Comics area shooting ray guns.
Right. It's time for an update.
Now it's like, now they're just inherently bad. They can just throw like freeze rays everywhere with their hands. So now it's like totally up here. But yeah, so that's a geeky explanation for geeky things about CSS. So yeah. I gave my nerd creds definitely here. But
nerd. But I can definitely understand that. There's a lot of, at least in my situation, seeing a lot of the wide-eyed and the headlight sort of students just saying these books are out there. It was difficult finding textbooks that would be in made for a designer
who's
never done this,
that
didn't
knowledge
that their experience with the internet was their iPhone.
Yeah.
That they used for Facebook only, and maybe the occasional phone call.
Wow.
Or they maybe had MySpace but laughed at their older sibling who really used it every day.
Right.
And for them to come into web design, there weren't really a lot of books that we could find for them. Finally, there was a book that came out, HTML and CSS, simply titled by John Duckett, but color-coded and very typographically
well-designed.
And all the students are like, oh, this looks a lot less intimidating. It doesn't look like...
As someone who's written several books, like, I am impressed by that book exists the way it does. And I think we should get him on the show and talk to him.
Like, I think that it's so great that book. Somebody needed to write that book. It wasn't going to be me.
But being able to see that solution of there's the HTML in blue, CSS in pink, and then in green was the result. So here's what you should see on your screen. And if it doesn't look like this, go back to the pink or blue one and then double check that you wrote it in that way. And
which reminds me, when I was growing up, when I was a young fellow, my very first computer was the ZX81. So-called, because that was the year it came out. So older than you, Sam. And it had 1K of RAM, although we got a 16K RAM pack. But you could do the basic thing, right? 10, print, 20, go to 10, all that. And that feeling of doing that and, you know, executing that little program and seeing the result on the screen was really empowering, you know? And, you know, played around a bit, but I never lost that feeling of like, wow, you could change things. It's really powerful. And then I didn't really use computers for many, many years. And then in the 90s, when Windows comes along and the internet's really sort of starting to take off on the web, I thought I'd tackle, you know, making a website. Because we were in a band in Germany.
Right.
Decided we should have a website. We had an email address, which was good, but we needed a website, a Hotmail address. So I thought I'd give it a try. And then an old friend from our college who was back in the States, and I knew he was working with computers in some way. So I asked him, what do I need to make a website? And what I was expecting him to tell me was, you need this piece of software.
Yeah.
Right? In the same way, you want to make graphics, you need Photoshop. Right?
Yeah.
You want to do video, you need this piece of software. To make websites, you need this big, expensive piece of software. Mm-hmm. And when he wrote back, he said, well, you open up a text editor, like, say, what would have been on Windows at the time?
A text editor?
Notepad. So, like, open up Notepad, and you type these kind of less than, greater than things, like H1. And P and stuff, and then you save that as .htm.
Mm-hmm.
Remember back then it was three letter.
Yeah.
And then double click it and it opens in a browser. And I was like, what?
Yeah,
like, I don't need a big piece of software.
Yeah.
And so I tried it, and I remember it was like an echo of that feeling I had with BASIC on the ZX81. It was like, oh, I can publish. I can change what's on the screen, and then I could actually put this out there on the web, and anybody in the world could access it by going to that URL. That is a really empowering feeling, the fact that anybody could do that. And I think maybe people have lost sight of that if they're what they're used to is, inputting stuff through a third-party form like Facebook or Twitter or something else. That's how they publish now, is through some third party. There is, and I don't want to sound like, some neckbeardy Unix geek or something, where you should be able to do everything by hand. But it's actually a very good feeling. It's a really empowering feeling of independence. I can write my own HTML. I can publish this document.
And like, I think you ranted about this before, but the view source is now harder to find in the browser.
Well, that's how it. So that's how I was learning. It was the view source, and as we said, there was Ask Dr. Web, and there was High Five, and there was WebMonkey, and the Web Design L mailing list ran by Steve.
Oh, Chandler,
right? That was hugely important. But yeah, view source. I, in the forward for, or the acknowledgements for DOM scripting, I thanked view source. Along with all these people I was thanking, I was like, thank you, view source, because that was such an important part as well. Although, interesting, going back to the origins of the web, Tim Berners-Lee was surprised that people ended up writing documents in HTML. Because HTML was kind of intended to write almost like index pages,
yeah,
where you'd point to the real content. But the real content would be in whatever format, you know,
right,
Word files or PDFs or whatever proprietary formats. And as it turned out, the HTML was easy enough to learn that people just started writing the content,
right,
in HTML. It was just good enough that yeah, it was fine. And it was recognizable because people had done HTML and they recognized some,
yeah,
of this stuff. And they you could pick it up pretty easily. But it was kind of an accident.
Yeah.
That was never really intended. It was a very happy accident, in my opinion.
Well, also, PDFs were designed to replace the web. So
yeah,
you're actually, like, because Adobe came out and said, like, yeah, you actually design it, and it's pixel perfect, and you just move it and move on and stuff like that. And people were like, oh, you mean this Word file that I've been having forever? I can just make a Word file and just put it on the web, and people would download it and fill it out and have to do some weird fucking thing. Then that became what we know as PDF. So.
Yeah.
And then Quark came out with something else, I tried to replace the web. And
yeah, I mean, in the 90s, a bunch of things came along. I remember somebody was like showing what was output by the editor that later became Go Live.
Oh,
was
it Greg's?
Yeah, one of Greg worked. And I talked to Greg about it,
yeah,
because he was like, oh, look, that markup you're uploading, all this proprietary stuff. He's like, look, what you remember at the time was it was not clear at all HTML was going to
go win
and
yeah,
or survive or you know, be this long-term format.
Yeah.
No format had ever lasted longer than a, you know,
yeah,
short period of time. So yeah, we were making stuff up. That was how stuff was,
uh-huh,
done. The longevity of HTML, I think, took people by surprise.
Yeah.
You know, how come William Lee? He was at CERN in the early days as well, and he placed a bet pretty early on that HTML would be around in 50 years,
yeah,
which is a crazy bet. 50 years for a computer format, you know, that's crazy talk.
Yeah.
But now, you know, that's, yeah, I'd back that.
We're like two-fifths of the way there.
Yeah.
So I think it's pretty good.
Pretty good. And like I said, you know, the design principles behind HTML, that email from Ian Hickson, it's by design, you know. They're thinking about long-term with,
yeah,
this stuff. So, yeah, I think he was pretty prescient with that.
Hopefully nobody bet on H Group.
Yeah. There's a betting pool for elements and how long they'll survive.
Well, that'd be awesome because then you could, like, you know, determine which ones actually people want and are going to survive.
That actually might not be.
And then you can have all these... Then you see the landscape of who's winning, and then you go into the discussion group and actually say, well, you know, you're really like winning the betting pool right here with this H group over here.
I don't know if that would work because I bet everyone would bet on the picture element, but it still won't make it into browsers.
Cause, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, let's talk about that.
That's not.
Okay,
that
sounds good. Is there anything, we've talked about a lot of things,
mm-hmm,
is there anything else that we haven't talked about that you're passionate about right now, or...
Off the top of my head, I can't think of anything.
Okay.
I'm passionate about going out and exploring Austin a bit.
Murphy's Tacos or tacos,
yeah,
in general?
Tacos, barbecue. I feel like I should see some live music, go to an Alamo Draft House show or something like that. But all the things you can't do when South by is on.
Yeah.
Oh, we had Artifact Conference at the Alamo Draft House.
I was telling,
yeah,
him yesterday, it was just milkshakes,
oh,
in the afternoon where you could add a little bit of whiskey or Bailey's or,
yeah,
things like that. Cookies made to order, fresh out of the oven.
Yeah, I was like, I was co-host, and I think the first thing I said, like, how many people have never been to the Alamo Draft House? I'm like, you're welcome. Just
that was the
yourself.
Best experience. I mean, to sit there for 2 days and just have food brought to you was,
yeah,
oh, that
was
good.
Yeah.
That kicks
nice
it up
feeling.
A notch.
Yeah.
Now, Remy organizes a conference in Brighton every year called Full Frontal,
mm-hmm,
which happens in a local art house cinema.
Mm-hmm.
One of yours. That's my idea. He was going to have it. He's going to have a hotel on the seafront. So I was like, no, Remy. To New York, so I've been investigating, you know, how much it costs to rent it out, and you could totally do it.
Yeah.
So he did it, and yeah, it was really, really good.
Yeah.
Comfiest conference seats ever.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was
definitely.
It's good.
That is awesome. How can people find you on the web and internet?
Adactio.com.
Mm-hmm.
That's the URL that I at least have some control over. if that goes away, it'll be my own fault.
Yeah.
And then generally, I'm Adactio on other third-party services like Twitter and
at
GitHub.
Plus all things,
mm-hmm,
right? At and plus and whatever other.
Yeah, wherever there's a social network, I'm probably,
mm-hmm,
on it as a Dactio.
Yeah.
You know, Flickr, Twitter, GitHub, Dribbble, Instagram, all the usual stuff.
Yeah.
But Dactio.com, mm-hmm, is the place I called home.
Cool. Well, thank you so much for taking time out of your visit here to Austin and being on the show.
My
pleasure. Like I said, we've been wanting to talk to you for a while, so it's been great.
Hey.
Cool. Thank you so much.